must jolt us out of our blissful slumber. For years, the Daesh terrorist group, which derives its Takfiri ideology from the Umayyads, has been unleashing horror on the Shia population in Afghanistan, targeting their houses, their mosques, their schools and hospitals. The bloodletting gains momentum every Muharram. This Friday, August the 5th, 8 people were martyred after a bomb attack to a handcart exploded in a Shia-dominated neighbourhood of West Kabul. It is the same neighbourhood of around 1 million people where the bombing of Sayyidul Shuhada High School in May last year martyred 85 Afghans, most of them young girl students aged 11 to 17. Then there is Yemen, the biggest and the forgotten tragedy of our times. Thousands of Yemenis have died over the years in the Saudi-led coalition's aggression against the country, with overt and covert support from Western regimes and the Israeli regime. Tens of thousands have perished due to starvation. These Muharram commemorations are essentially an expression of support and solidarity with these oppressed people, from Palestine to Afghanistan to Yemen and to other places. It's not a grief-centric ritual locked in the corridors of time. It's the reaffirmation of our pledge to speak for the oppressed, to rise up against tyranny, and to be the voice of the voiceless. History is the manifestation of the eternal conflict between the two poles of God and Satan, and in each period of time, these two poles have disguised differently. The evil forces almost always have faced a disgraceful defeat, in line with the Almighty's promise in the Holy Quran. And Allah will by no means give the unbelievers a way against the believers. In Karbala, it was Yazid's defeat and Imam Hussein's triumph, irrespective of the outcome on the battlefield, and that was made possible by those who valiantly unmasked the tyrants. Every revolution has two visages, blood and the message. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his companions undertook the mission of blood. The second mission is to carry the message of this blood to future generations, which was carried out by his sister, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, the saviour of Karbala. The lady who, in the aftermath of Karbala, led the caravan comprising women and children from Iraq to Syria and bravely confronted the tyrant Yazid in his Damascus court, showing us the way. Speaking up against injustice and oppression is the message of Karbala and the legacy of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and Sayyida Zainab, peace be upon her. That's also the crux of these annual Muharram commemorations.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we'll be examining the Israeli dungeons of Palestine and look at the way in which debt is wielded to entrap Palestinians deeper into Zionist unfreedom. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. Before that, though, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into the Western companies that profit from the Zionist dungeon system in Palestine.
The Israeli regime currently holds at least 4,450 Palestinians kidnapped in occupation dungeons. Among them are 160 children, 32 women, and 530 people held on administrative detention. Throughout 2021, the Israeli military arrested almost 8,000 Palestinians, including more than 1,300 children and 184 women. This system has generated massive profits for several well-known Western companies over the decades, who seem to have suffered little reputational damage for their role in suppressing the Palestinian people. So, which Western companies have profited and what services do they provide to those dungeons of occupation? US corporation Hewlett-Packard has provided servers, data storage and data security services for the Israeli prison system for the past 7 years. It has also signed deals worth over $1 million to provide similar services for the Israeli police. It has also been essential to the building of a biometric database of Palestinians for Israel occupation forces. Volvo Group, the Swedish multinational manufacturing corporation, is also intimately involved in the Israeli regime dungeons. Volvo and its subsidiary Merkavim provide the buses for the kidnapping and transporting of Palestinians to Israeli prisons. Volvo machinery has also been used in demolitions to aid Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The US company Motorola has also had a very key role in this infrastructure of spatial dominance. It supplies the Israeli police with the Astro 25 communication system through which the officers interact with each other. Motorola Solutions also set up the wide area surveillance system known as Motor Eagle for the Israeli Ministry of Defense. This system is essential to the illegal settlement network and apartheid wall infrastructure. Motorola Solutions even went as far as providing a special encrypted telecommunications system tailor-made for the Israeli military. The Mountain Rose project was designed to prevent the resistance from penetrating Israeli military communications. Motorola has also provided key components for Israeli arms companies like Rafael and Elbit Systems subsidiary IMI Systems. G1 Secure Solutions was previously known as G4S Israel, a subsidiary of the British outsourcing behemoth G4S. The company had over 7,000 workers in the apartheid entity and provides detection systems to the Israeli prison service. It was later contracted to carry out maintenance of the integrated management systems within the Israeli prison system. This included maintaining the CCTV system and control rooms. The company also provided ankle monitors for the jailers to attach to the legs of Palestinians. G4S was campaigned against relentlessly and eventually sold off its Israeli subsidiary. However, it has remained a part of the Israeli police infrastructure through its 25% ownership of the Policity Corporation. Policity trains Israeli police officers on a plethora of suppressive measures, from crowd control to interrogation techniques and undercover operations. Just as G4S was pressured to sell the Israeli subsidiary engaged in this work, so too must be the other Western companies party to the crimes of the Israeli regime.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Sham Murad. Sham is an Iraqi academic and legal researcher based in Birmingham in the UK. She's a co-founder of the A is for Activism group, and she's been described as Baghdad's finest and Birmingham's own. Sham joins us today by Skype. Welcome to the show. Sham, let me start with you. You've said in the past that Palestine is not negotiable. I wonder if you could tell us what do you mean by that?
Thank you for having me on the show, Chris. One of the regular demands that we hear expressed by imperialist politicians and media is for Palestinians to sit at a table with Zionist colonizers and Western imperialists and negotiate away their land and their rights under the facade of a peace process. So when we say Palestine is not negotiable, we are rejecting the demand for them to engage in talks to carve out how much land that the Zionists are allowed to colonize and under what conditions Palestinians are allowed to live on their land. Palestinians have been clear since before the Nakba of 1948 that Palestine from the river to the sea belongs to the Palestinians, and that they will not waver in their struggle for total liberation from colonialism and imperialism. No colonized people have acquired their land and freedom through negotiations with their colonizer. Palestinians have an inalienable right to fight for their land and for their freedom, a victory that will not happen through what Palestinian revolutionary Hassan Kanafani calls a conversation between the neck and the sword. For Kanafani, negotiations are not talks, but rather a form of capitulation. And that path is that one that the Palestinian masses reject en masse. Additionally, we also see this demand on the Western left for movements here to ignore the questions of colonialism and imperialism, or to put these questions to the side. So when we say Palestine is not negotiable, we also mean we reject the idea that of the Western left that advances progressive values on many issues, but refuses to take a principled anti-imperialist position pertaining to the global south, and particularly with regards to Palestine. The sheer arrogant expectation that Palestinians should accept anything less than what they had before 1948 is not negotiable. So a mass workers and people's movement in the West must be willing to fight for the liberation of all peoples against imperialism. And that, of course, includes the Palestinian people.
Indeed. Well, thank you. I mean, David, tell us a bit about the other US corporations that are invested in the Zionist colonization of Palestine. And what about the British corporations today, and for that matter, in the past as well?
Well, I mean, one that comes to mind is Airbnb, which, of course, was pressured to remove its listings in the settlements and then reversed itself and allowed the listings. They're still listed. You can still go and live in illegal settlements with settlers. And it said, by way of compensation, that it would give the money that it made from these illegal settlements to humanitarian groups, which, of course, is a way around the fact that they're collaborating directly with the illegal settlements. In the UK, I mean, I suppose the most famous one is Marks and Spencer's, which, as we've heard in this programme before, set up a recruitment centre for the Haganah, the terrorist force which established the State of Israel back in 1947-48. And all the way through this process, since 1948, Marks and Spencer's, the families associated with Marks and Spencer's, have been huge contributors to Zazim and indeed to activities in illegal settlements. So there's been, those are two examples, but there are more, where the business interests of Zionist leaders in this country and in the US have actually pumped millions of pounds into illegal activities in the settlements and indeed into ethnic cleansing in Palestine.
Mm. I mean, Cham, the previous report detailed significant corporate profiteering from Israeli prisons in Palestine. I mean, how do you think that connects to the struggles in countries like the US and Britain, where some of those corporations actually originate?
Yes, in Palestine, much like the US and Britain, prisons are used as a tool to repress colonized and exploited people. Leaders of anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements are incarcerated by a prison industrial complex that seeks not only to repress mass movements, but also exploit prisoners and profit off of incarceration. So we see the incarceration of revolutionary leaders like Moumaya Abu-Jamal in the US, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah in France, and Ahmed Sadat in Palestine by the Zionist entity. The law that political prisoners have all dared to break is the law of capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism. We also see, much similarly, surveillance corporations reaping profits from the repression and incarceration of colonized peoples, and know that Israel, the US, and other countries such as Canada and Britain exchange surveillance technology and policing tactics. This is seen through the collaboration between US police and Zionist military, the Canadian RCMP and the Zionist military units, and similarly the British police and the same training that they have received from Zionist military units. We know that a large amount of police and military technology that are used by British and American police are in prisons in the West, are tested on Palestinians by the Zionist entity. So it's important for us to continuously identify the relationship between the corporations and prisons and military, as these help us to then connect capitalism to imperialism and colonialism. We know that these are British corporations who benefit from prisons, both here and in places like Palestine. And it is pivotal for our activism here to be able to target these corporations that are complicit in the incarceration of colonized people fighting against imperialism and capitalism, including our comrades in Palestine.
Yes. I mean, David, I understand that HSBC previously divested from Israeli arms companies before, but how successful do you think have other pressure campaigns been in the past?
Well, I mean, these pressure campaigns can sometimes work, but it's not really very clear how effective they are and whether the results of the HSBC action did mean they had fully divested. So, you know, really the model we have to follow, I think, is the model pursued by Palestine Action, for example, in this country, of direct action. It's only through doing direct action like this that companies can be forced into facing the activities that they're complicit in and forced into actually withdrawing from them in a more sort of actually genuine way. So I think really that, you know, the lesson is that direct action is the way forward for these kinds of campaigns.
Yeah. Sham, tell us a bit about the relationship between neoliberalism and the privatisation of prisons.
Yes. In the 1980s, with the false project of neoliberalism, which was spread both abroad through the imperialism like we saw in Chile and the unfortunate death of Salvador Allende, and at home through the state policies of key figures like Thatcher and Reagan, we saw the privatisation of prisons as well as the shifting of funds from welfare services towards the military and police. This era saw the expansion of prisons, huge increases in numbers of the people incarcerated, which were primarily poor and racialized people. We also saw, with the expansion of prisons, is the expansion of prison labor and the privatization either of prisons themselves or elements of incarceration through public to private partnership. And it is through neoliberalism that the state offered new incentives for an increase in incarceration, meaning incarceration is not only as a tool for repression, but also as a tool for profit. As we saw, neoliberalism rolled back funding for things such as social housing and welfare. It rolled out funding for the punitive arms of the state, such as the police, who were tasked with incarcerating those in precarious positions who had now lost the limited social welfare that they had and housing that they had. Thus, neoliberalism, through the reallocation of funds, incentivized and allocated budgets towards punishing people and incarcerating those who had been made poor by capitalism. Interestingly enough, Frantz Fanon once wrote that in the colonies, it is the policeman and the soldier who are the official instituted go-betweens, the spokesman of the settler and his rule of oppression. And we see that through decades of industrialization, racial discrimination in housing and employment, and growing income inequality that have created pockets of intense poverty where jobs are scarce, public services are inadequate, and crime and violence are even more widespread. And even with the more intensive over-policing that we see today, people still feel unsafe, and young people continue to use violence as a predation and protection.
Indeed.
Any program
for... Yeah, we'll just need to just pause there for a moment, if we can, Sham. Thanks for that. Because we want to just have a look at this report on some of the cruel practices that are being used in Zionist prisons.
As we've seen, the Israeli prison system is a profit-churning factory of unfreedom for thousands of Palestinians. The profits are generated by Western and Israeli companies alike, but there's also a sophisticated system whereby the Israeli regime extracts profit from Palestinian prisoners by ensnaring them into debt for a myriad of whimsical reasons. Palestinian prisoners can be fined for missing the morning count, for returning their food plates to the jailers late. They can be fined to compensate for damage to property caused when Zionist guards beat them inside the jail. They can be fined for refusing to be strip searched or for protesting against the conditions within the facilities. According to Euromed Human Rights Monitor, in 2016 alone, it was found that overall fines of prisoners added up to an average of $500,000 per inmate. The Human Rights Watchdog commented that the imposition of financial fines on Palestinian prisoners has become a consistent approach adopted by the Israeli judiciary, where almost no sentence is passed without a fine. The next year, in 2017, found minors in Israeli prisons fined around $11,000 in 1 month alone. There are numerous examples, like the Alawi family in Nablus, who were forced to sell their home to pay off Israeli prison fines, with the threat of more jail time if the debt was not paid. There's also the case of Palestine's oldest female prisoner, Saadia Farajalla, who died just days after attending Israeli military court in a wheelchair and being told that she must pay 15,000 shekels worth of fines. The debt trap in Israeli prisons is real and a tool of economic warfare against Palestinians.
David, what about this despicable policy of using debt to ensnare Palestinian families while they're in prison? I mean, it's kind of beyond the pale. I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as you saw in the film there, the amount of money on average that young Palestinian prisoners are fined is about £125,000, right, in British money, that is. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the cost of two houses in the West Bank on average. So that's a huge burden of debt which every Palestinian prisoner is saddled with, and, of course, their families have to pay. And so it's a way of really immiserating even further the occupied people in the West Bank. It's extraordinary.
You're not kidding. It really is. Sham, you're involved, aren't you, in Palestine Action, in that movement? And what just say a little bit about what the connection is between that activism and the plight of Palestinian prisoners.
Yes, Palestine Action is an incredible direct action organisation that has targeted Albert locations across the UK aimed with shutting them down. Albert Systems is an Israeli arms company that tests its weapon on Palestinians and whose weapons have been used to repress, kill and incarcerate Palestinians. Albert Systems weapons have been directly used to facilitate Zionist raids, which have resulted in the arrest of the thousands of Palestinians. And it's the work of PalAction that they do in targeting these factories and directly challenging the ability of the Zionist state to arrest Palestinians. Additionally, a large portion of Albert's profits come from the Zionist military. Through shutting down their factories, PalAction is directly challenging the profits of Albert, which are directly extracting from the colonization and occupation of the Palestinian people. It's important to also note that this work challenges not only the repression of Palestinians, but of prisoners and colonized people around the world, as Albert has contracts and deals to sell weaponry to nations across the world, including US and England. Thus, the work of PalAction also threatens the global imperialist alliance rather than just that in Israel alone, and the profiteering made by colonialism and capitalism, and directly threatens the repression of colonized and exploited people across the world by Albert's weaponry.
Yeah. I mean, David, what kind of pressure do you think could be applied on companies that are profiteering from the ethnic cleansing of Palestine?
Well, I think as we've heard, I mean, the kind of pressure that's needed is that people need to directly target these companies. Mm. They need to have direct action. They need to have protests outside on a repeat basis. And some of the tactics that have been used by Palestine Action have been extraordinary. They've had an alliance with the local community. They've had support from the local trade union movement, in particular the fire brigades union. Indeed. And they've also engaged in direct action where they've deliberately damaged the factories where these arms are made. And not one of them has been found guilty of any kind of crime as a result of this. And this is a model which we need to follow for, I think, many other companies which are engaged in these really inhumane and appalling acts in occupied Palestine.
Mm. Sham, I mean, companies like Volvo, Motorola, Hewlett-Packard are deeply invested in the infrastructure of the occupation, aren't they? I mean, what do you think can be done to challenge them?
Yeah, there's a number of ways we can challenge these companies. Firstly, boycotts, divestment and sanctions, the role of campaigns which directly tackle the ability of these companies to be profitable and forcing their hand to change. Secondly, through direct action campaigns, which can target the factories and businesses of these companies. We see how overwhelmingly successful it has been with Palestine Action. But also just last year, we saw South African dock workers refuse to unload Israeli ships in solidarity with Palestinians. And this is the kind of action that can be necessary to force change. And thirdly, I think it's quintessential to broader struggles that seek to challenge capitalism, imperialism and colonialism, and understand that the role that corporations have in the global imperialist system, and thus not expecting them to be part of the solution, but rather organizing broadly against capitalism and neoliberalism, and understand the role it plays in the repression of all people.
Yeah, I mean, you have got a book club, haven't you, in Birmingham, Sham? I mean, I just wondered if you could tell us a bit about how you've kind of brought in the issue of Palestine and neoliberalism into that space.
Yes, absolutely. The very first text we studied in 2017 was Angela Davis's Freedom is a Constant Struggle. And there was many reasons for this. Part of it was to see how our struggles interlock with one another, because Angela Davis drew incredible distinctions between Palestine freedom movements and how they are crushed, and the Palestinian liberation and Black liberation movements, especially in the context of Ferguson. And even more interestingly, as we studied this text many years ago, and we've seen G4S now have their hands forced, she drew comparisons on how G4S uses its company to maintain and reproduce the repressive apparatus in Palestine, be it their prisons or their checkpoints. But also she drew the comparisons on how G4S is also used to deport Mexican detainees in America, and also the what we had seen in the UK itself with Jimmy Mbenga's deportation, and it was G4S agents and guards that had killed him. So it's this idea that G4S represents this growing insistence on what is called security under the neoliberal state, and ideologies of security that bolster not only the privatization of security and then privatization of imprisonment and then privatization of warfare, but just in general making it a more dangerous world for colonized and exploited people.
Yes. I mean, David, there's around 500 to 700 Palestinian kids imprisoned every single year, and mainly for things like stone throwing, and they can face sentences of up to 20 years. I mean, what kind of treatments are these Palestinian youngsters being subjected to in these dungeons, these Zionist prisons?
It won't surprise you to learn, Chris, that the treatment is not good. I mean, there's all sorts of mistreatment of prisoners, direct violence against them, torture, and all sorts of harassment of them. And the fine system, where they're fined for doing things which they haven't themselves done. Yeah. So when they get beaten up, they get fined for that. But so the damage caused by the guards beating them up, they get fined for that. So there's all sorts of ways in which they are oppressed and repressed every day that they are in there. It's extraordinary, and hardly anyone hears about it. But, you know, we've been able to talk about it today, and hopefully this is the beginning of people saying, look, this is not acceptable, this has to stop.
Well, I hope it certainly is a beginning, David, because, I mean, we've got a situation here where, you know, in South Africa, the apartheid system was held to account by the corporate media, but they are, the silence is deafening, it seems to me, when it comes to the abuses of these Zionist gangsters. But unfortunately, I can't ask for a response on that, David, because we are absolutely out of time, and so we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, and thank you to Sham, obviously, for joining us via Skype, and thanks to David again. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take firearms industry and other military-industrial complex big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame, says F. Douglas Stephenson, researcher, in an article published under the heading gun maker profits soar as bloody massacres proliferate in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. U.S. citizens are waking up to the fact that so many politicians can be so easily bought by the weapons industry, an industry that doesn't care how many people must die to protect their huge profits. SafeHome.org reports that after a record year in 2020, gun sales in the U.S. dipped slightly in 2021. Still, with nearly 19 million guns sold, 2021 was the second highest year for gun sales in the U.S., behind only 2020, when estimated gun sales topped 21 million. The previous record year was 2016, with about 16 million guns sold. Total estimated gun sales fell 13% between 2020 and 2021, but they remained higher than they were in 2019, up nearly 40%. The large number of weapons in the United States of America is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. The total number of guns sold in 2021 is more than double the number sold in 2001. In fact, sales in the U.S. rose by about 155% between 2002 and 2021. No state had more gun sales in 2021 than Texas, where an estimated 1.6 million firearms were sold in the nation's second largest state. Florida followed closely with 1.4 million firearms sold. DearLord.com reported that weapons makers Roger and Winchester both had profit spikes in recent earnings filings. Their latest 2021 quarters topped record sales the companies had experienced even during the height of 2020 gun sales surge. The numbers come after July 2021 came in as the second best July on record for FBI background checks on gun sales. Roger reported its net sales in the first 6 months of 2021 were up over $130 million or 51% over the same time last year. The company did nearly $200 million in firearm sales alone between April and June. That represents a 54% increase over the same period in 2020, even though the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and rioting drove Americans to gun stores at record rates during that time period. Similarly, Winchester reported the first 6 months of 2021 produced a $412 million or 108% increase in sales. The gun and ammo makers' sales increased even further by 110% when looking at the April to June period. Winchester's parent company, Olin Corporation, saw net income climb from a $120 million loss in the April to June period of 2020 to a $355 million profit in 2021. They went from a $220 million loss in the January to June 2020 period to a $599 million profit in 2021. In spite of the above numbers, many citizens are also realizing that the idea of the Second Amendment guaranteeing the right of individual gun ownership is radical and wrong, and was never intended by the founders to be a barrier to establishing stringent weapon safety and control laws for the U.S. community. Turning gun violence into a mental health problem is incorrect, dangerous, and irresponsible, as anyone with even minimal knowledge of mental health issues knows. It's of course true people who kill children en masse are crazy, but asserting this reality says nothing. All countries have mentally ill and violent people, but U.S. citizens are increasingly more aware that only the United States of America arms them. Although the U.S. public is demanding real changes for much better safety in weapons regulation, the toxic results of U.S. current lack of adequate weapons control policies continues its deadly pace. The United States of America cannot any longer allow the profiteering military-industrial complex and their beholden politicians to get away with hiding or changing the subject, hoping the public forgets about the problem until the next mass shooting. By using denial over many years to reject and avoid the need for stringent gun control legislation, the GOP and some Democrats have fallen into a miasma of self-induced indifference and dangerous permissiveness toward gun ownership and its deadly consequences. The large number of weapons in the U.S. is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. This is why resistance to legislative proposals to better gun control culture and gun violence itself seem to many gun owners as attacks on their own personality and national identity. The bigger, more powerful the weapon, the more powerful the gun owner feels. Many marginalized and enraged lone wolf murderers, thanks to easy access to assault-style weapons, can misuse Second Amendment gun rights to cleanse the world. 21st century U.S. culture still venerates violence with the U.S. myth of heroic frontier psychology, but at the very high cost of crippling and killing American children. Historian Roxanne Dunbar Oritz, in her book Loaded, A Disarming History of Second Amendment, gives alarming statistics about weapons and gun deaths in the United States of America. There are 310 million firearms in the United States, 114 million handguns, 110 million rifles, and 86 million shotguns. The number of military-style assault weapons in private hands, including AR-15 semi-automatic rifles used in the massacres at Majority Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, is estimated at 1.5 million. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average of 90 firearms per 100 people. The total gun deaths in the United States of America average around 37,000 a year, with two-thirds of those deaths being suicides, leaving approximately 12,000 homicides, 1,000 of those at the hands of the police. Mass shootings, ones that leave four or more people wounded or dead, now occur in the United States on average at the pace of one or more per day. Disturbing as that fact is, mass shootings currently account for only 2% of gun killings annually. And the number of gun deaths, 37,000, is roughly equal to deaths by vehicle incidents in the United States per year. The Second Amendment, written by James Madison and adopted in 1791, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Although generations of activists, gun owners, and jurists have disagreed about how this should be interpreted in a modernizing world, what has been recognized is what the Second Amendment was really to be used for. History professor Roxanne Dunbar Oritz documents in Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, the purpose of armed militias of the Second Amendment. The kind of militias and gun rights of the Second Amendment had long existed in the 13 British colonies and were expected to continue fulfilling two primary roles in the new United States. Number one, destroying native communities in the armed march to possess the continent. And number two, brutally subjecting the enslaved African population. Dunbar Oritz demonstrates that the violence sanctioned by the Second Amendment was a key factor in transforming America into a militaristic business powerhouse. As the fledgling nation embarked on its relentless westward expansion in the 19th century, the labor of powerful, meanwhile, America's gone culture was growing in tandem with the country's increasingly sophisticated publishing and firearms manufacturing industries. Pulp novels romanticized ex-Confederate soldiers and rifle-wielding frontiersmen. Brand name weapons acquired a special status. In the two decades after the Civil War, Dunbar Oritz writes, the Winchester rifle was fetishized for killing Indians, and the cult revival for outlawry. In the process, gun violence and civilian massacres were not just normalized, but commercially glorified, packaged, promoted, and mass marketed. In 21st century America, fantasy and myth about frontier psychology still continue being played out by Hollywood, video internet games, and other manufactured fantasies that promote weapon sales. Just as communities today rely on professional public health experts in epidemiology to control the incidence, distribution and control of disease in any population, so too for public safety and health, we should rely on experts in weapons control and distribution to advise and design adequate, stringent legislation for community weapons control or regulation. The profile of a gun safety program could include, number one, prior to approving access to any weapon, potential weapon owners should be required to get formal instruction and pass a rigorous background check. Number two, an annual inspection by law enforcement authorities on how ammunition and weapons are stored, plus full inspection of weapons themselves, should be conducted. Number three, banned weapons should be collected by law enforcement as well. And number four, reimbursement, if any, for banned firearms would be the responsibility of the taxpayer and should be considered an investment in public safety. After mass shootings, many have or will use an amateur or banal analysis of the psychology of killers to provide much-needed camouflage for the profiteering military gun industrial complex NRA. Declare that it is a mental health, behavioral health problem, all in the killer's mind, and perhaps we won't notice that. Pathetic U.S. state local non-controlled weapons policy results in amazingly high murder rates, suicides, and frequent mass murders. When deranged people have such remarkably easy access to arsenals of weapons, every so often one of them will go ballistic. We can't eliminate all political, religious extremism, or mental illness, but we can most certainly prevent people from having access to rapid-fire semi-automatic weapons and thousands of rounds of ammo. The UK has 1/6 Americans' murder rate, not because they are psychologically healthier or nicer than the United States of America. The UK and many other countries just don't have or allow the weaponry hardware to be available to do as much damage. Thousands of prayers and thoughts are of little value unless Americans accept the fact that their laws reducing access to weapons need to be greatly strengthened, not loosened. Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take NRA, firearms industry, and other military-industrial complex, big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers, thoughts, and condolences for dead children, grieving parents, and disrupted communities are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame for their preposterous and irresponsible scapegoating of the mentally ill, while letting politicians, devotees of loose access laws, and the profiteering gun industry itself continue to squirm out of any responsibility.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazyev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us, and we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and The present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It's changing both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years length, and every 50 years we have approximately technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago, and now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is going on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. These changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. Mm-hmm. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain the British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars designed by the British was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development.
At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergence of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new and which demonstrated a huge growth rates. The industrialization and growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, in the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. The basic unit in the organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money, which were used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There were no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy. In Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial-type state.
That's right.
These large-scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed, and the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the Central Planning